The famous line from the Brothers Grimm tale, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, in German reads as such. Spiegelein, Spiegelein an der Wand, wer ist die schönste im ganzen Land? In English, this translates to Mirror, Mirror on the Wall, who is the fairest of them all? Growing up, I often heard the phrase, women are the fairer sex. Therein automatically lies a deeper truth. The truth being that language is a tool to be used mercilessly in the oppression of voices that might someday pursue meaningful change. There is, however, another interpretation that I feel holds true. The current world is run by men and always has been. It is unfair to the extreme in every measurable way. In this aspect, I believe the phrase to be relevant. Women are fairer. I think women should be recognized for that fairness. I think with women in charge, we will have a greater chance for a fair society. I'm joined by Mischke in this episode to talk about feminism and patriarchy, the history of the feminist movement, and the different waves of it. I thank Mischke for the depth of her research and her time. I have added the books and movies she refers to in the podcast notes. Today is the eve of International Women's Day, where many societies come to show their appreciation for womankind. I wish it were always celebrated such. To under mic, clocking out. Enjoy. Dung weche pek kudwelo mabiro etu under mic. Dung parodit kod jok mawuoye tu under mic. Seche tin sud buta wawinjie tu under mic. Wola wachokre wabed piny biwawinje ero chako momet ndi tu under mic podcast makende. I'm joined for a second time by Mischke. Thank you very much, Mischke, for coming back. How are you?
Fine, thank you as well for arranging this podcast episode today, and I'm really happy to be here.
Yeah, I have to say, well, we talked about it a bit before as well, but your preparation is so phenomenal. I actually feel as though you're the one who's actually organized this this episode, and I just put together the link for our chat. But all I can say is that my compliments for the work you put into it. Do you want to introduce it then? Because you've done so much hard work here.
Sure, yes. Thanks for the compliment. I feel like this topic of like women's equality and gender equality and feminism definitely deserves certain research making, because even as an alumni student from University of York and also Gymnasium in Slovakia, I feel like this topic has not been enough sufficiently covered. So even me, myself, like a history student, I still need to kind of make, dive into these topics in order to be able to speak about it. So, and of course, it's a very inspiring topic for me, and it's a chance to get on a journey of why we are living in the society in which we are living right now.
Yeah, absolutely. A great introduction. And I mean, that will lead obviously to our main discussion points later on. But as I commented on, your preparation is fantastic. And so it's only fair to then hand over the mic to you, and you can sort of guide us through, because you've really done a lot of research into not only the history of the feminist movement, but also you've done research into the individual books which you think are very representative of the information, and you've made some suggestions for what people can read and the kinds of characters they should do research into. And also some movies which you've commented on. And I think this was really important that people then take this away and read about it or watch the movies themselves later on. So do you want to go into that a little bit?
Yes, sure. Basically, I would start with the first wave of feminism, which was mainly about getting the right to vote. And it all started with like anti-slavery convention in London in 1848. And this was like an event where basically women were not even invited, but some activists showed up anyway. And they took an inspiration and then organized another campaign in New York, Women's Right Convention, and then Seneca Falls Convention in Seneca Falls Village in New York. And basically, they invited also men around, but they allowed men to also speak on the second day of this event, just to probably give back the same thing that they have received at the anti-slavery convention. So quite interesting. And yeah, so they were basically just fighting for the biggest important thing in the equalities history, which was the right to vote. So the American feminists had definitely taken an inspiration from the British suffragettes. There are two movies about it. First one is, I mean, there are more movies about it, but I've seen two, and I'd like to definitely recommend them to people who would like to also maybe learn something about this topic or just to watch it. The one which is about the British suffragette is called Suffragette. It's from 2015 with Meryl Streep, who plays the Emily Pankhurst. These feminists were quite radical because there was not enough of attention given to them. So they had to become a little bit more radical in order to their voices to be heard. So they were sometimes like setting buildings on fire and throwing empty bottles into windows, etc. And they were often imprisoned because of this, and they went through lots of harassment, not just in public spaces, but actually they went also through lots of suffering also at their homes. They were often, you know, being judged by husbands or family members and so on. In prisons, they went through great suffering. They went on hunger strikes because they didn't have this kind of, they were not being considered as a political prisoners. So they were treated as any kind of criminal. And then in order to protest against it, they went also on these hunger strikes. And then the people in the prison would actually force feeding them. So that was really also in the movie a scene when basically these fighters, these activists had like a tube given to their nose through which they would be force-fed, for example. And this was repetitively like happening to them. So the British film is quite rough, I must admit, but yes, it's quite educational, and Meryl Streep is amazing as always. And then there is the American film, which is called Iron-Jawed Angels, and that talks also about the problem of feminism, for example, from also the view that basically, for example, African-American women were sometimes also excluded from this activism. So there was also a time where actually African-American women had to like fight even harder in order to even participate in this activist organization. So again, they went through the double discrimination that usually the also feminists now definitely recognize, because there is also like a white feminism, a term. Yeah, so that's kind of the two movies. One is Suffragette and the second one is Iron Jawed Angels.
I haven't seen these, but I've read about the issues at hand, some of the topics, and I completely agree. I feel that when we talk about African-American women, the way that they have unfortunately been treated throughout history, and then to come to have to justify their rights as women to have to justify their rights as human beings. As you say, they basically had to fight a war on two fronts. And I find that in itself horrible. On the other hand, as we're analyzing things, it's interesting how you can have a group of people fighting for their rights. And yet on the one hand, they say, we are women, we deserve this. But then on the other hand, they turn around and look at others and say, yeah, but you don't deserve it because you're not the right color. So these double standards, these hypocrisies that are involved within the early stages of the feminist movement, I find it an interesting study, even though obviously when we can look at it in from our modern perspectives and say that's just horrible. There are some similarities perhaps with some elements of the modern feminist movement. So there are individuals who are considered TERFs. These are trans exclusionary radical feminists. But this obviously is something which comes much, much later and is not involved at all in the first and second waves of feminism. So you there essentially explained the first wave and you gave some of the or two of the movies. But there are also other people that you'd like to sort of talk about. So you referred to Emmeline Pankhurst, but there are some other people, aren't there, so you want to mention?
Yes, exactly. And that's definitely the kind of complexity that this whole topic has. It's basically about always like going back to history. But at the same time, this is the thing that they are the long-standing dilemmas, this question about how women can actually get, you know, the equality and the economical independence and how can they really have their rights, you know, to own their bodies and to make decisions about their own bodies and everything. So at the same time, it's still very contemporary. These questions are still here relevant. But in order to find out about what was going on or why are we here right now, we always have to refer back to the history. So yes, and exactly what you were talking about, you know, with this inequality and this double discrimination that also leads to one of the book that I also came across, and it's called Burnout by Emily and Amelia Nagoski. One of them has a PhD and another one is also a musician. And the book was published recently, like in 2018 or 19, and they made a really comparison, or they explain like what it feels like to be an African-American woman, or like what it means to basically go through the double discriminations. They, if I can just read it aloud, because I think it deserves to be heard. They say, white men grow on an open level field. White women grow on far steeper and rougher terrain because the field wasn't made for them. Women of color grew not just on a hill, but on a cliffside over the ocean, battered by wind and waves. So this kind of comparison kind of can be really a food for thought, I would say. But let me also answer your question. Definitely there were some important suffragettes also in Britain that should be mentioned. And for example, Millicent Fawcett, who formed the National Union of Women Suffragette Society, or the family of Pankhurst, who were the radical ones and who were going through the whole kind of suffering in the prison, as well as Selina Martin and Leslie Hall. She was originally from Australia. Some of them were really creative, like some of them were camping around London and South London and doing some cool things in order to just show their enthusiasm and obviously fight for the rights as much as possible. So yeah, definitely these women deserve to be mentioned, and me myself, I really wouldn't just know their name out of nothing. I definitely had to remember them. Then there was this Emily Davison, who I think everybody heard of, that she is 40 years old, threw herself under King's Horse at the Epsom Derby, and she died in 1913, just before the First World War. And First World War was after the First World War was the first time that women got the right to vote. In 1918 in the UK, but just women who were 30 years old and who had like property or who husband had a property. So kind of really the first time in the UK when women got the right to vote was actually in 1928, regardless of age and property.
That law also extended to a lot of people and reduced the age, I believe, the voting age for men who up until then had been a lot older too. So that I think law introduced a lot of different, I'm tempted to say liberalization, but I'm not sure if that's necessarily the right word. But yeah, and we have to point out as well that the First World War proved in many ways to be a catalyst to the recognition that women can do a lot more than what society had until then or thought was the case. Because when so many men were away, basically the whole country was being run by women. And I'm pretty sure there was no difference in quality. If anything, it probably worked better. But anyway, that's a different matter. And this is the experience that society had after the First World War, right?
Yes, exactly. It was a really important time when women were able to kind of prove, you know, obviously they had to, because like finally they had the chance to be seen and to be heard, and then they could finally gain the right to vote, indeed. And that kind of brings us like slowly to the second wave of feminism, I would probably say, because that's around the time when civil rights were being raised, the question and the problematic of it. But mainly the second feminism was really blooming in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah, so and in the 60s and 70s, again, post-war period, a lot of rebuilding had occurred after 1945. And then you've got a new generation coming in, the baby boomers. And then this process of course, we fought for this country or these countries, and we deserve to have the rights of all other people who had fought for this country. And this was one of the, I believe, one of the factors behind also the civil rights movement. And slowly but surely, up until the 1960s, when laws were introduced. I mean, we often look at what happened in the USA, and thereafter we consider the different changes that affected different countries too. But I mean, as you say, the civil rights movement, and along with that, there was this second wave with feminism. And you've asked a question. So, what is exactly feminism and what is patriarchy? And I think feminism is a lot harder to define, so maybe let's talk about patriarchy and then we can look at feminism.
Okay, sure. Yeah, these questions are definitely a very complex questions, and for many people it might mean something different, and that's also something that, for example, the third wave or the current feminism is saying, that it's actually, you know, it means every person has a certain perception and certain experiences. So feminism can be quite personal, exactly. And patriarchy, for example, according to these authors that I have mentioned, Emily and Amelia Nagoski, who wrote the Burnout book, they talk about patriarchy in the way that basically they come up with a theory of human giver syndrome, which is usually like the kind of problem that women often face, that they are supposed to be always the kind of givers, you know, like from the motherhood role, so to say, that women are always expected to basically be there for everyone to hear their, you know, not just stories, but their problems, and to be affectionate and to be attentive. Also, it means to, of course, share, you know, and be very pretty and beautiful and basically give the energy all the time around, provide, for example, the household work for free, so the family can, you know, run and basically go, yeah, to fulfill its kind of potential. So they talk about this human giver syndrome, that it's part of the patriarchy. because maybe it has something to do with the way how we actually bring up men and girls or women, like small boys and small girls, when we allow often in society boys to focus on their passion and just, you know, be really ambitious and go for the goal without stopping on the way, whereas girls are often to be brought up in the way that they need to listen to others a lot, and they need to, you know, fulfill these kind of expectations that they're supposed to always give their energy away. And maybe sometimes on because of this, they if they are expected to, for example, provide the housework for free and to spend so many hours per week, because it's still been proven that mainly in all over the world, it's still the women who are doing the housework, which is not being paid. So this is the second wave feminism, is exactly about addressing this question of how women can become economically independent if they are still spending so many hours during the week on a household work which is not being paid yet. So this is the second wave, yeah. And it has still not been solved, like, until today. So that's why also the third wave feminists later on are like, still some of them are critical of the fact that we kind of forgotten to address this question.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if people go back and look at just some of the advertising from the 50s, 60s, 70s, you've got a man maybe wearing a suit, sitting in an armchair, reading a newspaper, and then there's a woman holding a cup of coffee to present to him. The kids are playing at his feet. So he is the patriarch. He is the man. And everything in the house revolves around this individual. And the fact that advertising was, this is your perfect home. This is your perfect lifestyle. This is what you should do. And all of these, this kind of subliminal messaging telling people that is your role. So it's no surprise, of course, that there was this wave for feminism, because women were basically saying, one minute, I want a lot more from my life. I'm not here to serve anybody else. I want to live. And we saw a lot of these movements which showed women basically doing what they wanted to do. And this was also greatly encouraged by lots of pop music. You saw a lot of rebellious young women coming through. Girls just want to have fun. You know, Madonna later on, obviously in the 80s, I mean. So that wave lasted quite a long time until it actually started to receive some success socially, didn't it?
Exactly, yes, but it's also, you know, great that she pointed it out, that it's really connected to the culture and to the messages that are being communicated over and often, like, through advertisement. And that's also the problem that is still right here in this time. It's about the messages that are being communicated. But yes, thanks God, it's kind of changing and evolving for sure. But there are still lots of stigmas and lots of stereotypes that should be really spoken about. And the culture and the music industry has really big power and big influence on how, you know, girls and boys are perceiving their own bodies and also what they inspired to. And that's exactly also what I was reading, this great Caribbean American writer, Audre Lorde. She actually wrote a book, and it's also available on YouTube, and I completely like recommend people to check it out. It's called On the Erotic, and she wrote it in 1978. And she was exactly talking about this misconception, because, you know, even when you mentioned Madonna and these like kind of pop singers later on, me as a girl, for example, who was brought up and growing up in the 90s, like, unfortunately, I actually see a lot of very much of negative impact of the whole, like, sexualization of the women bodies. Like, it's a little bit over the top, to be honest with you. And this is exactly why I'm happy that I came across to this writer from the 1978, this Audre Lorde, who is actually talking about what it really means, you know, how we can really be authentic women, how can we really own our power, you know, without being like manipulated and like just reduced to some kind of superficial sensation, you know, that also pornography brings around and has so nothing to do with the feelings. And that's why it's really important to kind of realize like our authenticity without any kind of expectations, which is really hard in this like neoliberal economy and in these times of consumerism, where there are so many businesses run by basically people who just wants to earn money on you being not satisfied with your body, for example, or, you know, not having enough beautiful face and spending 2 hours in front of a mirror and spending so much money on making your makeup every day, you know, whereas instead of that, the girls could be reading a book or making sport or be dancing or whatever they want to do, you know. So, and then that's why we are then kind of like having a crisis also of like identity and having also so high numbers of like eating disorders with young girls, you know. And also when I used to teach, like I've seen students and girls who couldn't even relax their bellies when we were having a singing lesson because, like, it's not fashionable. Like, everybody needs to have just, like, 90, 60, 90, I don't know, you know. And they are really girls. They are young. So it's kind of dangerous, you know, these kind of messages and this kind of superficial photoshopped idols that we are trying to sometimes, like, unfortunately follow. Like, this is sometimes I have also issues with these pop singers, you know. I really adore their talents, but the way how they are being like portrayed, it sometimes really does more harm than a good. When I just, yeah, maybe when you go to dance for a party, of course you forget about it because the music is eventually great. But if you are the kid who grew up on MTV, like I did, for example, then it's like, you know, I was 6 years old and there I've seen like whatever, Moulin Rouge, Christina Aguilera, and like it was just, I was too young to see such a thing, you know, and it has impact on the generation.
Yeah, I find it interesting because for me, when I saw people like Madonna in the 80s, Cher, they were saying to me, I own my sexuality. I own my body, my sexiness, and I do what I do on my terms. And I think in the case of both women, they had indeed gone through a lot of personal challenges to arrive at the stage of success to which they achieved. And they still go strong, of course, because they're still performing even now. But I do find it also interesting that when we talk about feminism, inevitably we come down to, or we talk about sex, we talk about the way that women are expected to either dress or behave. And this is an element of inequality, which you are perfectly correct to refer to. I remember reading a fantastic tweet by a woman. She put two pictures in. She put up a picture of lingerie, not her wearing it, just lingerie. And she said, my man expects me to wear this. So why is it then when we go to bed, he's wearing this? And then there's another picture of his boxer shorts with a hole in, a very tatty and so on. And for me, that spoke so much about the situation we're in, where, you know, you've got one group of individuals, they expect the other to do all the work, to do this or do that and so on, but are unwilling themselves to sacrifice just a little bit. I found that amazing. And I'm not going to talk about individuals, you know, personal experiences, but I think that was a fair comment from the woman, don't you think?
Yeah, most likely it's exactly like this, you know. They can just prove that the experiences that they go through, you know, this kind of perception that men has a right to comment on women's look and so on. Like, on one hand, of course, it's an aesthetics, you know, and I am also an artist and I always search for a beauty, and I'm also very like visually stimulated person, but there are certain kind of boundaries that maybe are a little bit like in our culture not being present anymore, purely because of the fact that, you know, sex sells and so on. But yeah, it's becoming an extreme, or at least I think it was an extreme. Now, luckily, it's also a little bit changing, also the expectations, and you know, also it's more about inclusivity, really also different body types and different things. Yeah, it's still a topic that that one can talk about, you know, especially also in the second wave of the feminism, still in the 60s, 70s, it was exactly also talking about the fact that, for example, rape is often mostly happening actually at home, you know, between wife and husband. So this was also, I think, part of the Civil Rights Act in 1964, that was introduced to basically protect the right of women, you know. So yeah, it's still a journey, and more we talk about it, and more we raise these issues with, like, among young boys and girls, probably the better it can be.
Yeah, and I mean, you mentioning the USA there, but also in Europe, there were some serious inequalities with regards to the law and legal framework, which were not addressed until the 70s. I think women, for example, were not allowed to have a job without the permission of their partners. They couldn't travel alone, I think, abroad. They couldn't take money out of their own bank accounts in certain countries in Europe. So I think these kinds of laws, they were introduced not so long ago. We're talking about 50 years. We really should take into consideration the fact that even though feminism as a movement has been going on for a long time, it's only recently that significant changes have started to be made. But on top of that, we do see this mini reversal of progress in various areas. And this is something that we're seeing now as well. And perhaps this is why we should also look at the third wave before we jump really into analyzing some of the issues that we should be focusing on and we should be very much aware of in today's society. Do you want to do the third wave?
Yeah, definitely. It's such also, you know, great comments that you have there. Exactly. It's like it's still quite young, or we see the fruit of the hard work of the people who really sacrificed sometimes their lives or their health, like the real suffragette. And we see the fruit first now. And then, of course, we need to kind of like look at the situation. We are living in a society where the democracy is quite like becoming quite fragile. Then there is the digitalization and so on. So that's why it's definitely worth of checking out the third and fourth wave, because apparently there is also a fourth one. But I also didn't have so much time to go into complete all the details. But, you know, when you were also mentioning this kind of difficulties that women had to kind of like get an allowance of someone in order to be themselves, this is like, I would say it's, I feel also a little bit like there is not enough of gratefulness, like that we are kind of like ungrateful, maybe also towards our mothers or so on, I don't know, like, because how bizarre is the fact that these women were all the time supporting their husbands, for example, to become writers, to become composers, to become scientists, to become politicians. Yet they themselves had to get an allowance from them to do what they wanted. And then we are questioning why there is not enough of female composers or of enough female writers, you know, or so on. They actually existed and they do, but they never had such a same amount of space to be heard and to be shown in the same way as men do. So that's the patriarchy, just to answer the last, like, the most important question that we raised at the beginning of the second wave, feminism. And the third one is around the 90s, or like the 80s, 90s, as you were talking about also with the artists, like it's becoming a little bit more playful. The third wave feminism is like also inclusive, exactly, of like different race, of different gender, you know, transgender, also like the homosexual rights and everything is being kind of like discussed in the third wave of feminism. So it's like more postmodern and a little bit more experimental and also personal. So there are certain feminists who say that they are the new wave and that feminism is very individual to everyone, and it's kind of like a let's talk about it and let's be really inclusive of every single problem. That's what it is about.
Yeah, and I also see, in addition to that, this element of I feminist or individual feminist, as you're referring to a woman's body, a woman's right. It's very individualistic. It's very much a question of who owns the right of access. And these are issues which are being called into question on a daily basis because such liberated countries like the USA are turning around, and you've got groups of men saying, actually, no, women shouldn't have to make this decision because we've already made the decision, and no, you can't do that. So the kind of hypocrisy which is being forced upon women in the USA. And the reason why we talk about the USA is because, unfortunately, when these kinds of events and decisions take place in the USA, they are also talked about and sometimes replicated in other countries. So when the Supreme Court in the USA overturned Roe versus Wade, straight away, the next day, there were conversations taking place in some parts of Germany, in Italy, in Poland, where they were talking about, oh, we should actually reopen the debate in our countries on abortion. So therefore, it's extremely important to talk about these things within the context of what's happening today. I love the fact that you refer to LGBTQ, or should we say non-binary rights, because for me, they are eternally linked. I think when we talk about gender equality, we have to talk about the freedom for people to be who they are, who they authentically are. I've seen lots of people ask questions and say, okay, how do you define a woman? Or how do you define a man? Or how do you define this or that? And if we're talking about maybe an academic discussion, then fair enough, people should ask any questions that they want. But for somebody to be authentically who they are, I don't think there should be an argument.
Exactly. Like, there is really a problem of this categorization, you know, of like that we are trying to categorize people into some kind of boxes, which can be really, in the end of the day, contraproductive, you know. And suppression leads actually to just more of kind of like suffering, you know. If also there are so many, unfortunately, also cases, like when I think of Slovakia, you know, and about this like a religious background and the Catholic Church, you know, where the priests are not allowed to have a wife and to have a family, you know, then you see how they are suppressing their own sexuality, that leads to more suffering, and then they are basically misusing boys, you know. And this is like, then they try to all kind of just like hide it and like nothing has happened and so on. But that's really exactly the wrong perception. So we actually need to allow people to just be free. And this is something that I, for example, while I was studying in England or here in Germany as well, like the Evangelic Church or Anglican Church, they are just more open-minded. You see homosexual priests, you see female priests, you know. And then, like, yeah, this is the way how people can actually be maybe like happy and to fulfill their potential. And from my own experience, because I'm an artist and a musician, I must admit that for me, the LGBT community and friends who are homosexuals have been the most trustworthy people, because often it happens to female artists that they are being exactly, you know, going through some sexism, unfortunately. If I have been at some events and there was a man in a position who is a heterosexual man, even though he has, for example, wife and so on, like he would be, you know, giving some strange suggestion and so on to me. And that's why I was always rather confused because I didn't want to be perceived through my like body, you know, even though I like to think of myself, yes, of course I can be attractive, then give me a compliment and let me do my music, you know. But it's like with LGBT people and homosexuals, it's all, always just about the art and like, you know, kind of like a support, mutual, normal, without kind of any manipulation, because this is the problem that patriarchy is also trying, as the Audre Lorde has said, is trying to manipulate the sexual true female power into certain way, and this is something that has to change eventually.
For the patriarchy, I think they are fighting a losing war when it comes to the inequalities that women face, because without women, there simply is no society. Without women, there is no grounding for human decision making. Without women, I think we simply do not have the ability to organize ourselves, the ability to plan, structure, develop, create, innovate. In all of the areas, I think, where human ingenuity, intelligence, compassion is important, you see women. And even though in history, lots of these fields have been covered by men, what history probably doesn't show is the fact that there are women operating in the background, feeding information, feeding thoughts, feeding ideas through, which the men claim for themselves. But obviously history has chosen to ignore that. So for this reason, I think gender equality prioritizes women, especially as there are so many, obviously, as a category of gender. I think women are the number one. There are more women on this planet than any other gender. But with patriarchy, what you have is, I believe, when feminists turn their attention and frustrations on non-binary genders, whether this is deliberate or not, they're actually doing the work of the patriarchy for them, because the people who are actually keeping non-binary down are the same people who are keeping women down. So it's only when we can address the issue, and the issue is your standard patriarchal system, which is keeping these people down. It's the system that needs to be changed. And once we've changed the system, if there are thereafter other issues that need to be addressed, then I'm sure the system will be better placed to address them. But First, we need to have a fair, representative, and respectful system. Let's get that.
Exactly, you know, and that's also something that I, for example, have experienced also in Berlin. There is this Frauen Museum initiative, and they do kind of like a peaceful protest on the 8th of March, like on the International Women's Day. And they just kind of show the fact that in galleries and museums, women still don't have the 50% of representation of their artwork. So, you know, and this kind of thing needs to happen not only in the art world, but also like in the parliament. You know, I always, even as a girl already, I was always imagining like, why not having 50% of female politician and 50% of male politician. Like, I think there is already a country somewhere in Scandinavia or somewhere where it kind of almost is happening. So I think that this kind of representation, when it will be equal, then yes, you are, I agree, then the problems would be solved in a more balanced way, and probably the voices would be basically covered. I mean, nothing is perfect, and we are still people, and it's all quite organic, so it doesn't have to be like, you know, like as if we were machines, like everything completely like reduced to numbers or so on. But there needs to be the discussion, and we definitely need to fight further in all the ways, you know. It's nice to also fight in a peaceful way, as usually people do, but, you know, as also in the history was shown, like sometimes you cannot be peaceful anymore, because then your rights will never be addressed, you know, and if we are going to be forever also peaceful, like also when there is already violence involved, like, you know, on the conflict of, again, like Russian and Ukrainian conflict, that's, for example, something that I completely, like, metaphorically see, like, this kind of typical, almost like, I don't know, like a macho style Russian kind of persona that is actually almost like, you know, raping a Ukraine. And this is actually one of my friend with who I cooperate on like concerts and readings. He's from Ukraine. He exactly written this in the text that he just feels like as Ukraine was being, you know, raped while everyone is like looking at it and not sufficiently taking action against like the person who is making this violence. But anyway, that's a little bit different topic, but definitely there needs to be action taken in order to have the equality. So around this International Women's Day, I think that there will be lots of awareness going on, but of course it needs to also happen like after the International Women's Day too, and yeah, in general.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, women are women every day, and not just on the 8th of March. Also, women need to be respected every day, and not just on Valentine's Day, and not just on their birthdays, and not just on the 8th of March either. And I think this is something which is quite clear to a lot of people. But I like to see this kind of understanding exhibited normally, as in on an everyday basis, but also with regards to any kind of decision making, as in I sometimes see people who are extremely respectful and so on of women or of their partners or of their friends, but then when it comes to making a decision, they don't even think to ask the woman in the room, what do you think, what do you want? They just speak to their friends, or when a woman is speaking, they speak over them. And they don't even realize that they've done it. But then outside, they say, yeah, I'm complete. Oh, of course, gender equality. So these are the kinds of microaggressions that I would like to see people be a lot more aware of and do whatever they need to do to remove that from their behavior. I mean, another topic that I wanted to discuss, and you kind of touched on it with regards to some of your personal experiences within the music industry, and obviously I don't want you to talk about anything which is perhaps too difficult for you to mention, but I mean, generally speaking, do you feel that it's more difficult for a female artist to get her art respected as opposed to simply a person who would be considered attractive and therefore be given the stage because of that?
That's a really good question. I was making a little bit of a little research again when it came to the numbers. So there was, for example, the issue of female conductors in orchestra. So there is still like only 13.11% of conductors are female. So only 13%. So I think that also proves the fact that kind of stereotype that we are still having in also music world, that the conductor, the dirigent should be like a man because like he is the one who does the gestures and everything, and like that's the strong kind of like masculine, you know, kind of power. And it's like so strange to still you know, see such a number, because like we do live in like 2024, and I would like to actually believe that it's getting better, but sometimes really these numbers prove that there are still some really difficult gaps going on, also with the, of course, like salary gaps and so on, like but on the other hand, I also must say that men themselves suffer often from the patriarchy, because they are also the ones who sometimes, if exactly we don't allow people to be who they are, they also suffer from the fact that they have to kind of suppress their emotions as well, that they are, at least, for example, in the Eastern Bloc, you know, like in the like communist or socialist Slovakia, like it was Czechoslovakia, like the people, the men were all the times like being expected to be like a strong man who is not really showing any emotions. And I mean, we are all individuals, and there are certain men who have a little bit more of feminine side. There are men who are maybe really this kind of like a masculine type, but I think that it really is important for also boys and to basically express themselves and to also, you know, be the emotional one. And it's absolutely all right, and it's like we have to basically be just more understanding, and we also need to make probably boys to become a little bit more empathic towards others, because we expect it from girls to be empathic always, but we don't really expect it from boys. And going back to my own experience, whether like the stage would have been given more to a male musician, I would say, for example, in music that as an instrumentalist, like, you know, if you play a bass or a guitar or like drums, like it's quite stereotypical in the way that's like the male kind of like area. So if you see a female drummer or female pianist, that's maybe also quite normal, but it's, yeah, can be a little bit like something unusual. So then the men, when I'm going through a jam session, for example, they are sometimes like, yeah, it's a little bit, you know, like surprise for them. What is, for example, an area where they completely leave it to a female is like the singing. That's probably really the most kind of like a usual place where female can express herself. But with the instrumental side, it is a little bit more complicated, I would say. And also, you know, to get into a music band, you know, and I love to play music with others because it's just wonderful. It makes you really like, you know, you share the emotions together from music and communicates it. But what often happens is like if you have a male band or a jam session with lots of males, like all of a sudden, exactly as if there is a female, it's like completely about like, you know, who can date her or who can, I don't know, like invite her to a drink, you know, and these kind of all games that just completely lose then the focus of the music itself. And it's, again, can be counterproductive. Yes, I have definitely seen these things, you know, not just that I would go through it, but I've seen it through, you know, my friends who are female singers or also instrumentalists.
Yeah, I mean, I find it interesting. I would also love to know, I think it's impossible to find out these kinds of statistics, but at what age people start to create bands. And as you say, I know when I was growing up, I knew of a few bands that would get together. And as you say, a lot of them were boy bands. I've seen a few, obviously, bands where they had the female singer and obviously the woman took center stage or so on. But then she was also expected to dress in a certain kind of way. So there was always that sexual element to the choice of the female singer. But I'm interested in knowing, and maybe you know better than I do, I'm sure you do, how many women's groups or girls' groups come together in comparison to boys' groups? And is this interesting even for girls when they go to school at the ages of 12 and 13 to form a group?
Yeah, that's also a great question. There definitely are girls' group, and like I would love to also, you know, there are some times in England when I used to exactly be in a duet, you know, with another female singer. Like it was so empowering and so amazing, but still I must admit that also at the university while I was studying music, it was mainly male bands, and like even in the course itself there were much more boys than girls. So it's like there are definitely female groups, but it's in my opinion, or at least from my experience, I always seen the bigger percentage of male music players. So it's a little bit hard for me to answer.
As I said, I think it's extremely hard to do research on that kind of level because we just don't know, especially me being a boy, as in I was never around when groups of 12 or 13 year old girls, when I was 12 or 13, when they were talking, I was not involved. So I don't know if they ever had the idea of forming a band. Whereas I know that boys who could play music, they straight away, one of the first things they did was, okay, let's get together, let's jam, let's meet, let's do something, and so on. And if there was a little bit of musical chemistry and somebody who could write, then something was created. But I never saw that really with groups of girls from that sort of young age. So I'd be interested in knowing why we can't push girls who are musically inclined towards taking that step of creativity, doing something for themselves, putting themselves on the stage as a group, because we can see these kinds of activities in other areas, in the sciences, in mathematics, in engineering. We see there's a need to bring girls through into that. We can see girls being pushed into directions of sport because finally it's women's sport is getting the recognition it deserves. We can see women coming up as authors. All of a sudden, the last 20, 30 years, there are so many fantastic women authors around. We're seeing a lot more women in politics. So we can see these changes. How far do you think we can get these things to go? And just as a final kind of question, do you think in our lifetimes we will experience real equality?
Yeah, that's also something that we probably have to think about. I am not so optimistic. I think that also what we should try not to forget is that whenever we also see a female as a, you know, politician or also as a scientist and so on, like they are often going through much more like a judgment, you know, she's always like either too powerful or she's like too shy or she's like, there will be always some kind of label. So maybe I can see in our lifetime eventually potential equality if we will stop being judgmental of the female leaders and of the female musicians, you know, because like this is the thing, like we really should try to just let them be as they are and to run the countries as like they, you know, I like to believe that they want to do it in the best possible way. Sometimes you also have like of course leaders who doesn't matter what gender they are, they just are incapable, but that's another story. But I think that if in case we will really stop being so judgmental, we can maybe reach the equality sooner than later.
I hope you're right. I really do. I would love to experience real equality. I think it would seriously impact all different areas of life. I think we will finally achieve something bordering peace in our time. And I think it would also address quality of life across the globe much more easily. And I'd like to think it would start to seriously address climate change. I think it's fundamentally important that we have this kind of shift for all of these arguments. But thank you very much, Mishka, for your time. Again, I'm so impressed. I'm almost afraid to ask you for our next topic for when we chat, because I'm going to have to pick something where you can do no research, so that I don't want you to fall under the responsibility, the burden of stressing so much. But thank you so much for all of your work and your wonderful input.
Thank you as well. No, I just felt very, you know, also privileged, but also like really responsible to finally also have the chance to talk about it in a quite peaceful way, you know, because I also like to believe that like more equal society we have, maybe also more peaceful, let's say.
We will talk, I'm sure, again soon. And yeah, have a wonderful weekend
too.
Thank you.
And
bye-bye.
and my